Hello, and welcome to Administrative Remedies, because you can't fix what you don't understand. Brought to you in part by the University of Tulsa College of Law. I'm Gwendolyn Savitz, an associate professor here at TU and the Associate Dean of Research and Intellectual Life.
And I'm Mark Rourke. I'm the Dean of the College of Law.
We'll be breaking down complex doctrines with real-life analogies and examples to demystify the world of administrative law for everyone trying to understand how government actually works.
Agencies are the main way the federal government gets things done. It's not through Congress, for reasons we'll be addressing over the course of this series.
We've spent the last two episodes exploring the major questions doctrine, when Congress has to speak super, super clearly to issues of vast economic and political significance. Today, we're turning to another doctrine that controlled how administrative law functioned for decades, and that is Chevron. So, Mark, we're going to go back to the babysitter,
okay.
Except now we're going to make her a nanny. We'll call her Crystal. She's been with this family for 2 years. She does the school pickup, homework, dinner, the whole routine.
Okay, so she knows how our life works and she knows how the kids work.
Yes. She also knows that homework needs to happen before screens or everything goes downhill. The kids have sloppy handwriting. They're rushing through it. They don't retain anything. So it's 6:45. The kids' favorite show is on at 7. And Crystal's told the kid that homework needs to get done first or the kid can't watch. The kid does not like this, calls up grandma at 6:55 and says, "Crystal's making up rules. Mom and dad didn't say when I had to do homework. They just said my homework has to get done."
What does grandma do then?
This we could think of as a Chevron situation. So the instructions are vague if the parents just want to make sure the homework is done. Crystal has expertise. She knows the kid. She knows the family. Under Chevron, grandma would defer to Crystal's reasonable interpretation, meaning the kid has to do the homework before they can watch TV, even if the grandma might have let the kid do it afterwards.
And that's what courts did with agencies.
Yes, for 40 years. If Congress left something unclear, and as we've talked about, Congress can leave a lot of things unclear, courts deferred to the agency's reasonable expert judges. So in this example, Crystal obviously is the agency, but we needed to bring in the grandparents. We couldn't just have the parents coming back, because the whole point is that the person making this decision about what the delegator meant, what Congress meant, isn't Congress. So we need to have a third party in there.
So this is about who gets to fill in the blanks when Congress is being vague.
Yes. And Congress is vague all the time, sometimes because they can't agree on stuff.
But also because they can't predict every situation that a particular agency would face.
Right. Like we talked about the Clean Air Act before, how Congress wants the EPA to regulate air pollutants, but doesn't necessarily know what a pollutant should be. Like carbon dioxide, does that count?
Yeah. I mean, we breathe it out, but is that pollution?
But what level of danger and what kinds of danger should the agency have to act on? One death per million, per billion?
And they didn't specify.
They can't for so many of these areas. Environmental statutes, workplace regulations, food safety. These statutes are full of terms like reasonable, feasible, appropriate, harmful, fair.
And someone has to put numbers to give meaning to those words.
Yes. So the question is, who should be the one doing that? The agency that works with that kind of issue every day, or judges who only see that issue occasionally?
I mean, agencies that have more expertise with this area, do more practice with it, probably are in a better position to decide what those numbers should be.
That's what the Supreme Court said for decades. But to understand why this is such a big deal, let's talk about the actual case itself. If we're thinking about Chevron, this is 1984, Reagan's president. His EPA is trying to help the industry while still complying with the Clean Air Act.
Reagan's EPA is helping the industry? That's shocking.
I know. So everything comes down to one word in the Clean Air Act, and that is source.
Source of what?
Source of pollution. So the Clean Air Act said that areas with dirty air, which it called non-attainment areas, in those types of areas, any new or modified stationary source of pollution needs a permit. And getting that permit meant you had to install the best available technology.
Let me guess, that's going to cost a lot of money.
Millions of dollars per smokestack. But here was the important question. What counts as a source? Is it every individual smokestack?
Well, that would make sense because each one would then emit pollution.
Or is the entire factory one source?
Oh, okay. I can see that.
So Reagan's EPA came up with the bubble concept. We can picture a giant imaginary bubble over the entire industrial plant.
Like a dome.
Yes. And everything inside that bubble or under the dome, all the smokestacks, the vents, every emission point there, that is one single source. So if you have a factory with 10 smokestacks and you want to modify smokestack number 3 to increase production.
Which would increase the emissions from that stack.
Yes. So under this individual approach, you need a permit and expensive controls on smokestack 3. But under the bubble concept, you would look at all of the different smokestacks combined, and there might be something you could do to reduce emission at another smokestack. Maybe you're shutting it down, or maybe it's doing something where you can put cheaper control technology on that one.
So you have a total cap of what you can do, and sometimes that means you can modify the different things you have at your control.
Right. So you can't be emitting more pollution total from that factory, but you could adjust what you're doing to try and even that emission out.
Okay. And then you wouldn't have to have a permit.
Right. You wouldn't need to go through the expensive permit process, and you wouldn't need to go through the expensive technology to improve the emissions for that one particular smokestack.
It does seem a little bit like playing fast and loose with what the rules are governing industrial complexes.
That is what the Natural Resources Defense Council said, too. So they sued saying that the whole point in these non-attainment areas was to reduce the pollution whenever possible. And if you let companies just shuffle pollution around under an imaginary bubble, that would defeat the purpose.
What did the statute actually say, though, about the source?
Well, it just defines stationary source as any building, structure, facility, or installation which emits or may emit any air pollutant.
Those are all different scales of emission, right? So a building is smaller than a facility.
Yeah, so a building could mean one structure, a facility could mean the whole complex, an installation could mean a single piece of equipment, or potentially the entire industrial installation.
So essentially, both sides could claim they were right in how they were interpreting the statute.
Yes, both sides were absolutely convinced that the plain language of the statute supported them. The case goes to the Supreme Court, and Stevens writes an opinion that creates what becomes the Chevron two-step.
Sounds like a dance.
It does, a little easier than the Macarena. So this one just has two moves. Step one, has Congress directly spoken to the precise question at issue?
Meaning, is it crystal clear on what source means within the statute?
Yes, that would be what they're looking at here. And at this stage, courts are really supposed to try. They're using all traditional tools of statutory interpretation. They're looking at the text. What do the words mean? They're looking at the structure. How does this provision fit in with other provisions? They're looking at the purpose. What was Congress trying to achieve with this?
So judges can't just glance at it, throw their hands up and say, it looks confusing to me.
Exactly. They need to genuinely exhaust every traditional tool of statutory interpretation. But sometimes, after all that work, the statute is still genuinely ambiguous.
Like stationary source, like we have here.
Yes, exactly. This is definitely an ambiguous statute under that standard. So when that happens, we go to step two. If the statute is ambiguous, did the agency adopt a reasonable interpretation?
Reasonable according to who?
So that was the key with the test. Reasonable didn't mean the best interpretation. It didn't mean the interpretation the judge would choose if they were choosing fresh, or the one that the judge thought best served the statutory purpose. It just had to be reasonable.
That's a pretty low bar.
Yes. The agency didn't need to be right in the judge's mind, just reasonable. And that could be within a fairly broad area. If it was reasonable, the agency wins.
Even if the judge hates the outcome.
Even if the judge thinks it's terrible policy. Even if the judge thinks there's potentially a better interpretation, the reasonable agency interpretation beats whatever the judicial preference is.
So in Chevron itself, then,
we say step one, is statutory source clear? No. As we've established, it could mean an individual smokestack or it could mean the entire plant. So step two, is the EPA's bubble concept reasonable? And the court says yes. Focusing on total plant emissions is a reasonable approach. Again, the EPA can be choosing to allow businesses to control whatever is cheapest for them to control while still making sure that we're not increasing the total emissions from the facility.
Wait a minute. In this case, then, the environmental groups lost under Chevron.
Yes, they did. EPA won. EPA's approach was against what the environmental groups wanted there, so they lost.
I thought Chevron, though, was about agencies doing more regulation.
in this case, deference meant less environmental protection. Reagan's business-friendly EPA won. But it's what happened next that mattered.
Let me guess, the tables turned with a new administration.
Shockingly, they did. So when Clinton came in, his EPA issued much stricter environmental rules. Industry challenged them. When that happened, the EPA would cite Chevron and say, our reasonable interpretation should win.
It became a double-edged sword.
Yes, every administration found Chevron useful when they were defending their policies because, as we've established, there's a lot of ambiguity in most statutes.
Okay, but how does this actually affect regular people? This seems pretty abstract.
Let's look at a concrete example. Organic food. Congress tells the USDA to create standards for organic labeling, but the statute just says products should be produced without synthetic chemicals and using methods that foster cycling of resources.
Foster cycling of resources. What does that even mean?
Exactly. So the USDA has to get specific. What percentage of organic ingredients will make a product organic?
I don't know, 51%?
USDA said 95%.
Okay, that's a very specific number.
It is. Someone had to pick it. So they said at 95%, you can say you're organic. At 70%, you can say made with organic ingredients. They also decided things like organic cows will need access to pasture 120 days a year.
Why 120, not 100, not 150?
They're trying to interpret fostering cycling of resources. It's going to be a lot easier in some parts of the country to keep cows out for a lot longer than other parts of the country.
Okay. This is really deferring to the people who have expertise on the ground to say what these vague words might mean within their industry. Is there another example?
Net neutrality. Whether internet providers are going to be considered information services or telecommunication services.
Okay. I know this fight and it keeps changing.
Yeah. Under Obama, they're regulated as telecommunication services, and that means heavy regulation. Trump comes in, they're now an information service, hands off. Biden comes back in, back to telecommunications.
It seems very chaotic. The rules change every 4 years.
This constant flip-flopping, this was one of the major criticisms people had about Chevron, that we would defer to whatever the agency interpretation was, and the agency interpretation could change.
Was it really that big of a change in 1984?
This is what is so important and what most people don't really understand. Courts were doing this long before Chevron. Let's talk about United States v. Hammers. This is from 1911. It's a perjury case, and the entire prosecution hinges on whether the Desert Land Act allows someone to assign a land entry. Here's the part where the court discusses what the district court said about agency deference.
It was also conceded that the rule often authoritatively announced is that where a court is doubtful about the meaning of an act of Congress, the construction placed upon the act by the department charged with its enforcement is in the highest degree persuasive, if not controlling. And then the court said, such decision, however it was said, only determined in cases of doubt, and as the court found no ambiguity in the act, decided against the ruling of the department and the contention of the government.
Here the district court said, if I had doubt, I'd defer. But I don't, so I'm not going to.
And the Supreme Court didn't buy that.
No. Look at how the Supreme Court responds.
We do not find the Act of 1891 as clear as the learned district court did, and must give to decisions of the land department the weight to which such case the court acknowledged they are entitled.
There it is. Once we determine there's some ambiguity, the agency's longstanding interpretation carries weight, so they deferred to the agency. Here's another one from 1980. This is just 4 years before Chevron. It's Ford Motor Credit v. Mulholland. Here the court deferred to the Federal Reserve Board's longstanding interpretation that lenders didn't need to disclose acceleration clauses on the face of consumer credit contracts.
Deference to the Federal Reserve is compelled by necessity.
Compelled by necessity.
A court that tries to chart a true course to the Act's purpose embarks upon a voyage without a compass when it disregards the agency's views. That's rather poetic.
It is. Keep going.
Striking the appropriate balance is an empirical process that entails investigation into consumer psychology and presupposes a broad experience with credit practices. Administrative agencies are simply better suited than courts to engage in such a process. Simply better suited. They're just saying agencies are better than us.
Yes, this was decades of deferring to agencies.
Okay, so if this was so established, why was Chevron special?
Part part of it is that at the time Chevron was issued, it wasn't special. This was not a big case. It wasn't viewed as such when it came out. And one way we can tell that is that the very day Chevron was decided, June 25th, 1984, they decided another case using traditional agency deference and didn't even mention Chevron.
The same day?
Yes, the exact same day. This was Sure-Tan v. NLRB. And here the question is whether undocumented immigrants count as employees under labor law.
Oh, that's quite controversial.
Yeah, it has huge implications. All the statute says is employee means any employee.
And that's not really all that helpful.
It's not. Circular definitions generally aren't. The NLRB said undocumented workers are covered. The employer said they're not really employees, and the court deferred to the NLRB. But here's their reasoning. Can you read this part?
Since the task of defining the term employee is one that has been assigned primarily to the agency created by Congress to administer the act.
So assigned to the agency here.
The board's construction of that term is entitled to considerable deference, and we will uphold any interpretation that is reasonably defensible. Reasonably defensible, that's basically Chevron.
It is, but they're citing a 1944 case, not Chevron, which they decided the very same day.
Did the justices not talk to each other?
These were written by different people. It's the same principle, we're going to defer to the agency, comes out on the exact same day. It's safe to assume that if the court viewed Chevron as a new test and a change in the way they were interpreting agency law, they would have used the opportunity to apply it to another case that they were issuing the exact same day on agency deference.
That's actually pretty funny.
It shows Chevron wasn't revolutionary. It was just one way of expressing what courts had always done.
Why did then Chevron become the standard?
Mostly because this two-step test was crystal clear. This was a long-standing thing that the court had been doing for a long time, but it was also being expressed in a lot of different ways. Plus, this was ideologically neutral. Reagan's EPA used it for deregulation. Clinton's EPA used it for stricter rules. Everyone found it useful sometimes.
A truly actual bipartisan doctrine.
Yes. And it was at the court, too. This was a unanimous decision, which Sure-Tan was not, although there were kind of different groups that were voting in them. This was seen as just straightforward, neutral administrative law, not politics. So deference is the court accepting an agency's interpretation, even if they might have chosen differently. It's not blind acceptance. It's just respect for the expertise and institutional role of the agency.
The court really does have to work at step one before moving on to step two.
It's traditional tools of statutory interpretation. These are the methods courts use for every other case to try and determine statutory meaning. They look at the text, the structure, the legislative history, the purpose, interpretive canons. This is functionally what courts do in every case. This is why Chevron wasn't some sort of complete judicial abdication. We didn't go straight to, is this agency interpretation within the realm of reasonable? It was only when the statute was actually ambiguous.
Okay, before we wrap up today, help me understand the theory here. Why should agencies get any deference at all?
There are several justifications, and they can lead to different results. The first is expertise. Agencies know their subject matter.
Makes sense. EPA understands pollution better than judges.
Next one is democratic accountability. So the agency heads are appointed by elected presidents. And if you do not like what an agency is doing, theoretically, you can elect a new president. Judges, in contrast, have lifetime tenure and are accountable to nobody.
But then that makes interpretation seem political.
Yeah, we can think about whether this is law or politics. Critics say Chevron enabled lawlessness. Defenders say it enables democratic choice within statutory bounds.
Could say all law is politics at a certain level.
You definitely could.
So what's the third theory?
So the last one is congressional intent. When Congress is using vague terms, that might be because they're deliberately delegating that choice to the agency.
Or it could be that they couldn't agree on specifics.
Yeah. So sometimes this vagueness is going to be because they want the agency making the choice. Sometimes it's because they couldn't reach an agreement and they had to compromise. Sometimes it's going to be because it just never occurred to anybody that what they were doing wasn't clear.
But and there could be like a fourth theory here, which is if Congress wanted to be more specific, this agency rule incentivizes Congress to be more specific rather than leaving their words to be interpreted by agencies.
Yes, exactly. If they knew exactly what they wanted and they could agree on that, there wouldn't be any reason in letting an agency take a chance potentially interpreting something differently. Chevron assumed that if there was ambiguity in the statute, that meant Congress had delegated it. Critics say that's backwards. Ambiguity just means Congress didn't decide, so courts should decide.
Any other theories?
Well, there's one that's just practical necessity. Here's what Stevens said about it in Chevron.
Judges are not experts in the field and are not part of either political branch of the government.
All right, keep going.
Courts must, in some cases, reconcile competing political interests, but not on the basis of the judge's personal policy preferences. So judges lack both expertise and political authority.
This is really an argument about judicial modesty. But critics say interpreting law is exactly what judges do.
Even when it requires technical knowledge.
That's the tension. Is interpreting stationary source a legal question or a policy question?
It kind of seems like both.
Chevron said when the legal question is unclear, it becomes a policy question, and that we're leaving to agencies. Critics, in contrast, would say that it is always a legal question, and that is always for a judge to decide.
Even the hard ones.
Every case.
Well, let me make sure I've got this. Chevron created two-step tests that formalized what courts have been doing for almost a century, deferring to reasonable agency interpretations.
Yes, and for 40 years, this shaped the entire administrative state. How agencies wrote rules, how businesses planned compliance, how Congress wrote statutes.
And every agency regulation we have talked about, so organic food, net neutrality, they all depended on Chevron.
Virtually everything agencies did depended at least to some extent on Chevron. Drug approvals, we're looking at whether something is safe and effective. For workplace safety, we're looking at whether something is feasible. In environmental areas, we're looking at what is the best available technology. In financial regulation, what is systematically important.
All agency interpretations of vague terms.
Yeah, those are all really vague. Under Chevron, courts would defer to any of these interpretations that seemed reasonable. Thousands of agency interpretations have been upheld under Chevron over the last four decades.
But now it's gone.
Yes. We won't really take apart the death of Chevron for another couple episodes. Before that, we'll have to talk about Skidmore, the other kind of theoretical deference that courts can give to agencies.
So that does it for today's episode on administrative remedies. Thank you for joining us today. Please, if you enjoy this podcast and enjoy this episode, give us a like on Spotify, iTunes, or whatever platform you're listening on. And be sure to tune in next time where we'll continue to dive into the contours of administrative law, because remember, you can't fix what you don't understand.